Up. Thank you very much. Okay, guys, I'm recording this only because I then will try to post it on my podcast and on my YouTube channel. And then, as I said, after I do this presentation, if you wish to interact with me, if you wish to ask questions, then please subscribe. One of the benefits of subscribing to my exclusive content is that only subscribers get to do a Q&A. Sometimes I get a lot of people showing up, other times few people show up, so we can have very intimate conversations, but I don't take any questions during the public X Spaces session, because it becomes very difficult for me to manage, especially I've held previous ones where, several thousand people showed up and I get completely lost in terms of how to manage the whole thing. So today what I want to do is continue something that I started, I think it was 4 weeks ago, and I posted that lecture from the X Spaces in The Sad Truth 1651, so you can go and check it out. So The Sad Truth 1651, which was, I think, about 4 weeks ago. In that lecture, I had discussed the key tenets of evolutionary psychology. So what are some of the precursors of evolutionary psychology? These include Darwinian anthropology, human ethology, behavioral ecology, sociobiology, mimetic theory, gene culture coevolution. All of these disciplines are part of what's called the evolutionary behavioral sciences. And then I talked about what are some of the key tenets specifically of evolutionary psychology. I won't go into all of them here. But, if you're really interested in evolutionary psychology and want to understand what are some of the statements that evolutionary psychologists make about the human mind, then please go back and check that X Spaces session, as I said, from about 4 weeks ago. Today, what I'd like to do is something that I covered several years ago in my public outreach. I think it was The Sad Truth number 275. So this is I would say about 7+ years ago. But today I'm going to go over it and maybe add some new insights. Specifically, what I'd like to do is discuss what are some of the reasons that causes people to have such a disdain, I mean, generally toward evolution, but more specifically towards evolutionary psychology. The reason why I think this is, there are several reasons why I think this is a very interesting topic. One of which, on a personal level, is that it has very much defined my academic career, because as some of you who follow my work know, my academic work is at the intersection of evolutionary psychology and the behavioral sciences in general, and consumer behavior, psychology of decision making in particular. And very early in my career, so this is, I finished my PhD in 1994, very early in my career, I had a hard time understanding why so many social scientists had such animus towards evolutionary psychology. Obviously, these are not dumb people, and yet the second that you would try to apply the evolutionary lens to understand why, people in general do what they do, and specifically why employers or employees or consumers, why do they behave the way that they do from a biological perspective, then people's brains would blow up. And so this was actually my original foray into what later became, the greater culture wars. It all started into looking at these parasitized minds. Why is it that they were so anti-biology, certainly in the business school? And so in my 2011 book, but I've written a lot about it since as well. In my 2011 book, in the first chapter, this is the consuming instinct, what juicy burgers, pornography, Ferraris, and gift-giving reveal about human nature. I had a whole bunch of, anti-evolution points that typically detractors of evolutionary psychology bring up. And so what I wanted to do today, X Spaces lecture, I talked about what is evolutionary psychology. Today, I thought I would spend time talking about, what are some of the reasons why people have a visceral animus towards evolutionary psychology. So I'll just go through all the ones that I've listed here, maybe add a few additional points. then I'll close this session. And then, as I said, I'll open up another session. If you wish to continue the conversation, we can do so via the subscriber space only. All right, guys. So the tractor point number one. Now, so I'll read the position and then I'll offer a rebuttal. So Darwinian theory is ideologically dangerous as evidenced by the number of cretins who have misused it to advance their criminal and nefarious ideologies. So many people who have a disdain for biological-based reasoning when it comes to humans is because there is a history of all sorts of really nasty folks misusing evolutionary thinking to advance their political ideologies. So what became known as social Darwinism, although it has nothing to do with Darwinism, was a movement that was started by British social class elitists who said, hey, look, we're the upper class, and there's a natural struggle between the classes. It's a Darwinian struggle. And so if the lower classes end up dying in squalor and from tuberculosis and they don't get education, hey, that's just the natural assortment of things. It's a Darwinian struggle. And so if you cull out all of these lower class people, so what? So that became known as social Darwinism. So you're using a competitive evolutionary argument, quote evolutionary argument, to justify why you would be in the upper classes and all those other folks would be dying of tuberculosis. Of course, it had nothing to do with evolutionary theory, but it was usurped to serve a particular political agenda within the, you know, class warfare. Then you've got the eugenicists, say, who were, you know, let's say you're a homophobic eugenicist and you think that there is a gay gene that needs to be stopped from proliferating in the gene pool. Well, then, hey, eugenicists would say, well, let's sterilize people who have that, quote, detrimental gay gene, and then hopefully in the same way that in animal husbandry, you select for particular traits when you're looking for a docile dog or a fatty duck, or you know, people have known how to do artificial selection for millennia. Well, the argument from eugenicists is, hey, you can use these principles so that you can cull out particular traits out of the human gene pool. Hey, that's Darwinian. Of course, it had nothing to do with evolutionary theory, but again, a political movement is usurping biological-based thinking to serve its interests. I'll take the extreme example of the Nazis. The Nazis come along and say, hey, there's a natural struggle between the races. We are the Aryans. Sorry, Jews. Sorry, gypsies. Sorry, gay people. You lose. It's only natural that, you know, we eliminate you. That's just part of the Darwinian natural order. And so because of all of these various cretins who misused biological-based reasoning to serve their political agenda, you end up with all sorts of social scientists who have a reflex to completely abhor biological-based thinking. So, for example, cultural relativism, which is a movement that was originally started by the anthropologist Franz Boas, and then it was promulgated to many of his famous doctoral students, most famously Margaret Mead. So cultural relativism is a rejection of human universals, that there is such a thing as a shared biological heritage across all people. Cultural relativists argued there is no such thing. Everything is culturally constrained, and therefore it's the ultimate orgiastic negation of biology. There is no biological-based human nature. And so number one is this idea that we have to reject evolutionary theory because it's simply too dangerous to allow it to flourish. Which, of course, is insane, because that would be like arguing, well, we should, get rid of physics, you know, because atomic bomb, right? Oppenheimer. Yes, it is true that placed in the wrong hands, all sorts of scientific knowledge could be misused. But we certainly don't build edifices of bullshit when it comes to understanding human nature or human behavior simply because we wish to avoid the misuse of applying biology to the human condition. And so I quickly learned in my scientific career that I would get all sorts of editors and, you know, leading journals rejecting my papers without even sending it for review. They would be desk rejected. What are you talking about hormones when it comes to consumer behavior? What kind of nonsense is it? What do you think? We're some kind of gorillas? We're chimpanzees? Well, yeah, we're animals. We're just consumer animals. Okay, so that's number one. Let's move on to number two. Evolutionary theory amounts to biological determinism. Namely, evolutionists believe that our genes usurp our free will. So there's a whole bunch of imbeciles who think that if you invoke a biological argument for human behavior, this means that we are nothing but mere executors of that biological blueprint. But of course, evolutionary psychologists understand the what's called the interactionist framework, which is our genes interact with the environment to generate behavior, right? It's always an interaction. So even genes themselves are turned on or off as a function of environmental inputs. And so the idea that if you believe in, you know, if you invoke evolutionary principles to explain human behavior, you are denying that humans can have a range of possible behaviors. They're just going to biologically, deterministically implement, you know, genetic code X. It's just pure nonsense. It's just if you actually argue that position, all that you are doing is you're putting up a big neon sign next to your forehead saying, I am a gargantuan imbecile who understands nothing about behavioral sciences or about biology, right? It's always an interaction between our genes and our environment. So that's number two. Let's move on to number three. Oh, this is a good one. I originally generated this list in chapter one of my 2011 book, The Consuming Instinct. I've since learned a few years later that there is a name to this third point that I'm going to make now. It's called the human reticence effect. And you'll see in a second why it's called that. So number three, biological instincts and drives might be applicable when explaining the behaviors of animals. However, humans are first and foremost cultural beings. So the reason why this is called the human reticence effect, it's because there is this kind of visceral reticence to apply evolutionary-based reasoning to explain human behavior. So somehow, biology and evolutionary theory applies to every single living organism on Earth except one. They're called humans, Homo sapiens. So Homo sapiens exists in a reality that transcends biology, right? And many people will argue, you know, as an ontological statement, that what makes us human is precisely that we transcend our biology. That's the definition of what it is to be human. We are a cultural animal. And of course, that's pure, as my British friends say, pure shite, okay? The fact that we are humans doesn't mean that we transcend our biology. We are no different than any of our other animal cousins. As a matter of fact, you can take, for example, let's suppose I'm trying to explain the evolution of a particular sexual signal in the mating behavior of a salamander. Well, if I use the exact same methodology, theories, epistemology to argue for how humans have evolved certain sexual signals in the mating market, the exact same, nothing changes. So I apply mechanisms X, Y, Z to explain the evolution of the sexual signal of the male salamander, and I apply the exact same framework to explain the sexual signal of a human male. When it comes to the salamander, it's really rigorous science. When it comes to explaining human mating behavior, well, that's just quasi bullshit science, right? You can't apply evolutionary theory to humans. And then there's a class of folks within this group of detractors that are perfectly willing to concede that evolution matters when it comes to human affairs, as long as that thing that matters stops at the neck. So, for example, if I use evolutionary theory to explain why our lungs operate the way that they do, oh, great, good job, Professor Sapp. If I use it to explain why pregnancy sickness exists, oh, beautiful job, Professor Sapp. If I explain it to understand why we have opposable thumbs, beautiful job, Professor Sapp. But once I try to explain something above the neck, right, to the organ that defines our personhood, right? I mean, the organ that defines each of the people that are in the current X spaces that makes us each different is our unique minds. And somehow, if I were to apply evolutionary theory to explain the evolution of our minds, well, then that just becomes quack Nazi science. Okay. Let's move on to number four. EP, or evolutionary psychology, is strictly concerned with the cataloging of human universals. Again, this is a wrong position, but I'm going to read it and then rebut it. So EP is strictly concerned with the cataloging of human universals, while most social scientists are interested in understanding behavioral heterogeneity. So what does that mean in less fancy language? What the people who believe in this position are arguing is, well, evolutionists are only concerned in studying all of the things that make people the same around the world, meaning human universals. But we're interested, we meaning these particular social scientists, we are interested in cross-cultural differences. We're interested in cross-individual differences. Why does one person prefer chocolate mousse and another person prefers, fatty steak? And of course, as I explained in the last lecture, it is not true that evolutionary psychology is only concerned with human universals. Yes, we do study things that are universal across all people. There is a evolved, shared, biological human nature. But also, evolutionary theorists study cross-cultural differences, as I explained last class. So, for example, the fact that certain cuisines are very spicy and others are very bland, that is a cross-cultural difference, and it is perfectly explainable by an evolutionary framework from behavioral ecology. And the idea is that spice use has evolved as an antimicrobial property to solve a very real biological problem, which is that in cultures that have a higher ambient temperature, you have a greater proliferation of food pathogens, and therefore having spices solves as a cultural adaptation to a biological problem. So it's simply not true that evolutionists only study human universals. We study human universals, we study cross-cultural differences, and we study inter-individual differences. All of these are within the purview of the evolutionary lens. So again, imagine, so I'm housed in a business school, I'm housed in a marketing department. Imagine how powerful it is for me to be able to go to an international marketer and say, hey, I can exactly predict for you when a particular advertising message is going to be transportable across all cultures, because it is part of a human universals. And I can tell you when you need to tweak it to culture-specific conditions and so on. So it's an incredibly powerful meta-framework that we can use, not just in the behavioral sciences in general, but in, say, international marketing or international consumer behavior. So there you have it. Let's move on to number five. This one is probably the one that pisses me off the most, because it's the one that is most often aped by my academic colleagues. So number five is, evolutionary theory largely consists of unfalsifiable, post hoc, fanciful, and elaborate just so stories. You can't imagine, through all of my years of public engagement, the number of walking Dunning-Kruger effects, people who think they know a lot but actually know nothing, who've come at me saying, "Ah, but come on, you're an evolutionary behavioral scientist. That's not a real field." Oh yeah, sure. all of us, starting with Darwin, are just a bunch of babbling morons who've just been faking it all along. We just basically take a cigar with a martini and just construct post hoc fanciful stories. We don't use this thing called the scientific method to test our hypotheses. No. We wing it, right? Now, the reason why this pisses me off so much is because it really is like the phoenix that never died, that keeps rising, right? You kill it and it rises again. Because with each new generation of anti-evolution detractors, you get a whole new generation of babbling idiots who say, but come on, bruh, it's all post hoc nonsense. Now, the reflex comes from the fact that evolution, it has historicity, right? It's like saying, well, the astrophysicists who study the Big Bang, which happened 16 billion years ago, I mean, they're not doing real science. You weren't there 16 billion years ago. You're just coming up with bullshit stories about the Big Bang. So all astrophysicists, all geologists, all oceanographers, anyone who studies a historical science, I don't mean history, I mean a science that is rooted in a distant past, they just make stuff up. They just sit, as I said, with like a velvet a suit with a martini or a cognac with a cigar, and they just pontificate nonsense. Now, why is this particularly galling to me? Because some of you who know my work, I've not only published, this stuff in several, very prestigious scientific journals, but in chapter 7 of The Parasitic Mind, which I hope most of you have read, and if you haven't, you need to fix that problem right away, because it is the ultimate global mind vaccine to all the bullshit you're seeing in life. Well, in chapter 7, which is a chapter that I titled How to Seek Truth, I explain the epistemological tool of nomological networks of cumulative evidence. Now, that's a mouthful. But what am I saying? What am I doing there? If I want to prove to you that something is a universal adaptation, I will get you data from across cultures, from across time periods, from across species, from across methodologies, from across dependent measures, from across theoretical frameworks, all of which triangulate to demonstrating that the argument that I've made is truly universal, because it applies not to 30 undergraduate students that I ran in my lab. It applies across cultures. It applies across time periods. It across other species exhibit the exact same behavior. And so the idea that evolutionists sit around pontificating by coming up with post hoc fanciful stories, I mean, literally, it is the exact opposite of what we do. If anything, as I've explained on numerous occasions, the evidentiary threshold that evolutionists abide by in order to make an adaptive argument is extraordinarily higher than the other sciences. And yet, Egg on Twitter, who has been masturbating in his basement since 1973, is unemployed and never finished grade 11, feels completely comfortable writing to me and saying that everything that I've done in 30 years as an academic has just been post hoc storytelling, right? So that's, I was asked recently, what is the thing that I was on a show hosted by a British psychiatrist who asked me, by the way, first time I've ever been asked this question. That's why I remember it so well. At the end of our chat, he said, Professor Saad, you've been a professor now for 30 years. What is the singular thing that has most surprised you about human, human behavior, about human phenomena? And I thought, wow, what an amazing question. So I thought for a second, I thought, it's the inability of people to alter their positions once the position is truly anchored, which, by the way, goes against what I just said about building nomological networks of cumulative evidence. Because if you are a truly honest interlocutor, you would come into the debate with me and saying, I'm going to listen to your arguments, and then I'm open. If you convince me, I'll change my mind. Or if I convince you, you'll change your mind. But the reality is, and that's the most difficult part, is I can't get you to come to the table and grant me the decency or the humility to allow me to build the nomological network of cumulative evidence for you. Because you already know the answer, and nothing that I'm going to say is going to alter your position. And regrettably, it's not just the eggheads, anonymous eggheads on Twitter who are like that. Regrettably, in my now long academic career, many academics exhibit exactly that lack of epistemological humility. And goddamn, is that disappointing, right? Because you go into academia thinking, you know, you've got this kind of naive view of this ultimate noble profession of, you know, epistemological purity, where all we care about is seeing truth. Most of my colleagues wouldn't recognize intellectualism if it bit their ass. They're just careerists who are just interested in advancing their career. And I say this not with any, I don't mean it with any venom. It's because, you know, obviously academics are intelligent, they're educated, but many of them truly lack this intellectual curiosity that, you know, every academic should have. Okay, so that's number five. Let's move on to number six. Darwinian theory amounts to believing in a godless universe. It is part and parcel of the growing atheist, secularist, and humanist movements. So oftentimes, many people, especially religious people, will abhor, well, evolution in general, and then evolution psychology in particular, because somehow it is viewed as anti-God. And, I mean, it isn't, right? It is frankly agnostic. I mean, you could technically be an evolutionist and fully believe in evolution. And the way you would do that is through what's called natural theology. So you could say, well, the process of evolution is so exquisite, it is so extraordinary in its ability to generate the profound biodiversity that we see on Earth, that is a manifestation of the divine. So if you needed to reconcile, you know, evolutionary thinking with your personal religious beliefs, you can certainly do so. So evolutionists, I mean, statistically speaking, they're likely to be atheists or non-believers, if only because on average, academics are more likely to be non-believers than believers. And in many cases, the more prestigious the academic becomes. So for example, the more likely you are to be in the National Academy of Sciences, the greater your, you know, the number of atheists within the society. So yes, in a sense, more education leads to less belief, but evolution itself is not making a pro or anti statement to God. Okay, so it is perfectly reasonable for you to believe in both, just like, you know, and for example, in my case, I don't. They're to use the term of Stephen Jay Gould, the late paleontologist, they are non-overlapping magisteria. In my case, in other words, I can understand why people have a need for religiosity, and of course, as a scientist, as an academic, I can understand the importance of using the scientific method to understand you know all sorts of phenomena. Where I don't like is where religion tries to make statements within the scientific realm that are demonstrably false. So, for example, if you are a young Earth creationist and you're saying, well, no, the Earth is 7,000 years old, and it's so because of whatever you quote in your book, in your holy book, well, then I have a problem with that, because it is my job as an academic to be defending the truth, to be generating truths, to be at least seeking in whichever means I have at my disposal, which is the scientific method, to seek truth. And so if you make statements that I know are false, then I'm going to be upset and attack you. But frankly, a lot of people in the past used to think that I'm hostile to religion. I'm only hostile in the context that I just said. But I fully understand that the default value for humans is to be religious. In other words, it is antithetical to human nature to be a non-believer. So those the folks who have historically thought that, you know, I'm part of the new atheist movement have got it wrong. I just don't like when religion encroaches in areas where it does not belong. All right, next, number seven. We got three more, guys. Number seven, Darwinian theory is, when I say Darwinian theory, I also mean basically evolutionary psychology. So Darwinian theory is morally dangerous in that it provides explanations for reprehensible actions such as adultery, rape, child abuse, marital infidelity, violence, right? And this, by the way, is one of the most common critiques that I see from the general public. And it usually comes in the following form. Let's suppose I explain why humans have both evolved a desire for long-term coupling, right, monogamy, but also at the same time, paradoxically, both men and women have evolved a desire for, you know, extra pair copulations, to use the zoological term. So we've both evolved to try to find a mate with whom we bond over the long run, but we've also evolved to look for opportunities to head off behind the cabin with some other potential mate. Now, when I explain the evolutionary reasons for sexual variety seeking, then someone will get upset and say, ah, that's so immoral. You are using science or the cover of science to justify bad behavior. That has to be arguably the dumbest statement that a human being can make. Because let me draw an analogy. Oncologists study cancer. They study why cancer arises, how it develops. Do you then come along and say, hey, doc, you're justifying cancer. You are condoning cancer. Don't study it, doc. Right? Condemn it. Right? That's the level of stupidity. Humans both have the capacity for endless positive acts, parental love, romantic love, sibling love, altruism, compassion, empathy, generosity. Those are all part of the behavioral repertoire of humans. But also, humans rape, kill, steal, cheat, conquer other societies, steal their women, steal their resources, covet, get murderous in their jealousy. So humans are a complicated creature. We are endowed with endless positive traits, and regrettably, we are endowed with endless negative traits. And both of these sets of traits are within the purview of an evolutionary analysis. So you can't just study the evolution of empathy and, okay, that's okay. But you don't study the evolution of why child abuse exists. Okay? You're not justifying it. You're not condoning it. You're saying it's a real thing that happens. And is there a set of predictors that we can use to study child abuse? And as some of you may have heard me mention in the past, the way I got turned on to evolutionary psychology is in my first semester as a doctoral student at Cornell. I was taking an advanced social psychology course by Professor Dennis Regan, taught by Professor Dennis Regan. He assigned a book called Homicide by Martin Daly and Margot Wilson. And that book was about patterns of criminality that happen around the world and across time periods, and they used an evolutionary lens to explain it. That's when I was bitten by the bug. Now, why am I mentioning this? Because one of the classic examples that they give in this book is they demonstrate that the greatest predictor of child abuse, 100-fold greater than anything else. So I don't want to hear about all the bullshit social science explanations that explain nothing. 100-fold greater predictor is whether there is a step parent in the home, right? That's why we've got what's called the Cinderella effect, right? The Cinderella story, fable, is a universal one precisely because it maps onto a human universal, an ugly human universal, but a universal nonetheless, which is that on average, step-parents are less likely to invest in their stepchildren than they are in their biological children. Taken to the extreme, you get child abuse from a step-parent to a stepchild. Now, the child abuse takes different form depending on whether we're talking about a stepfather or a stepmother. So it's not as though the stepfathers are evil, but the stepmothers are nice. It's that the pattern of abuse changes. For example, sexual abuse is much more likely to be with a stepfather, whereas emotional and psychological abuse is that, hence the Cinderella story, comes from the evil stepmother archetype. Okay, so we're not condoning it. We're not justifying it. I remember I went in 2006 to give a talk on then what was my first book was coming out, The Evolutionary Basis of Consumption. And they had a top evolutionary behavioral science group at the University of New Mexico, one person of which was in that group was Randy Thornhill, who's a evolutionary biologist who's been on my show, actually. Thornhill, check it out. Great guy. Well, he had written a book back in, I think, 2000 with Craig Palmer looking at an evolutionary explanation of rape. Now, you could imagine the kind of flack this guy had. Oh, you disgusting patriarchal pig. Are you saying that it's okay to rape? Of course he wasn't saying that, you abject moron. He's trying to explain why rape happens. He's trying to better understand it so we can better prevent it. Right? He's not trying to justify it. But again, people have this visceral reaction that if you explain some ugly behavior via an evolutionary lens, that means you must be justifying it. Bullshit. Okay, number 8. We're almost done. And then, as I said, you want to continue this party, subscribe and join me for the exclusive Q&A period. Number 8. Darwinian theory posits that humans are brutish and selfish creatures engaged in an endless, quote, survival of the fittest struggle. Well, first of all, survival of the fittest is not a term that was generated by Darwin himself. It was, if I recall correctly, it was Spencer. But as I just mentioned a few minutes ago when talking about the last point, that's not true. Evolutionists and evolutionary psychologists explain both why we've evolved positive traits and negative ones. It explains why we have evolved romantic love and sibling love and parental love and altruism and compassion and kindness and generosity and empathy. But it also explains why we can be competitive and deceptive and duplicitous and why we can cheat on our partners and why we can be violent and so on, right? All of it is within the purview of evolutionary theory. So no, evolutionists don't believe that we are these cavemen going around hitting everybody with our clubs and dragging the ladies into the cave. We're both capable of a multitude of laudable behaviors and regrettable behaviors. It's all part of the soup that makes us human beings. And finally, number 9, which is one that comes up probably every single lecture one that I've ever taught in my 30 years as a professor. First, I'm going to state it formally and then I'll explain it. Providing a datum at the individual level that is contrary to a fact that holds true at the population level is sufficient to falsify a given evolutionary principle. So that's a mouthful. So let me explain it concretely. If I say human beings are a sexually dimorphic species, meaning that they've evolved predictable and universal sex differences. So for example, men are taller and heavier than women within the human species. Some species don't exhibit size sexual dimorphism. Humans do. Okay? If I make that statement, which is an incontestable truth, somebody will raise their hand in class. You ready? But my Aunt Nina is taller than my Uncle Joe, Professor. Oh, shit. Darwinian theory is dead. Back to the drawing board. Right? If I say men prefer to mate with women who are not menopausal on average as a preference, Someone will put up their hand. But my Uncle Joe is dating a woman who's 12 years older than him, Professor. If I say that humans are a sexually reproducing species. But Professor, my Uncle Joe is gay and he only dates hairy Turkish guys. So it can't be that humans are a sexually reproducing species and that they've evolved this sexual instinct to procreate. If I say that humans have evolved these sets of behaviors because it is part of their repertoire of survival instinct, someone puts up their hand, but Professor, my Uncle Joe committed suicide. So how could it be that humans have evolved a survival instinct through natural selection if there is such a thing as suicide? So you see all the examples I just gave you? It's a recurring cognitive trap that doesn't allow a person to recognize that coming up with a singular datum does not violate the statement that holds true at the population level. Every single basketball player in the WNBA is taller than every man in the Philippines. That doesn't mean that this violates that men are taller than women. And sorry, please don't send me an email now saying, but my Uncle Joe is from the Philippines and he's 6'2". Okay? So you take these 9 points that I just said, and there are a few others. I mean, I won't keep us much longer today, but you can see how there is a whole slew of cognitive obstacles, emotional obstacles, ideological obstacles that makes evolution in general and evolutionary psychology in particular very non-palpable to many people. So even though it is absolutely as clear as the existence of gravity that evolution is the only game in town and that evolutionary psychology is the only game in town when it comes to creating a consilient framework to understanding human behavior, people just have a visceral animus against it because usually it attacks one of their foundational ideological positions. If I'm religious, I hate it because you're killing God. If I am a postmodernist, I hate it because there are no absolute truths. If I'm a feminist, I hate it because you're saying that there are sex differences. So all sorts of people will then come out of the woodworks hating evolutionary psychology for completely erroneous and frankly imbecilic reasons. So there you have it. But by the way, that's what makes it so exciting. That's what, because I know that whenever I write something, I publish a paper, it's very unlikely for it to go unnoticed. Because even if you are a non-academic, you're a layperson, you are drawn to enter that discussion. Because what is more sexy and exciting and interesting than trying to understand the evolutionary roots of human behavior? There you have it, people. I can't believe you just got 43 minutes of this lecture for free. So do the right thing. Go and buy the GadSad books. Subscribe for, I think it's $5 or $6. I can't remember what the subscription is. By the way, they take about 50% of the subscription fee from me. So for the price of a single latte, you could be supporting content creators such as yours truly. Please do so. Yes, I do this for purity reasons, just because I love to engage in intellectual pursuits, but also I can't pay the mortgage with purity. So if you appreciate what I do, please consider subscribing, and I will now get off this thing, head off to my subscriber only space. I hope to see you there, and there I will take all of your questions, as long as it happens within 30 minutes, because I would still like to be married when I finish this chat. Take care, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Talk to you soon. Cheers. A subscriber only space. I've got two requests, so let me open it up. I've got Zara and Doctore with a... Hold on, let me just... I'll say yes to both. I'll give you the thing. either of you can speak. Take it away. Who wants
Thank
to
you,
go?
Dr. Sad again.
Who is this, Zara?
Yeah.
How are you, sir?
So good to see you. I was hoping I didn't miss one in the last 4 weeks. I keep trying to check, but you tweet so often that I'm afraid I'm going to miss one.
No, no, you didn't miss anything. I had one 4 weeks ago, which was what is evolutionary psychology? And now I had the detractors. So you're right on track. Welcome.
Yeah, I did the notes on this one the same as the last one. This was fantastic. I have some questions to ask, but I'm going to stop talking right now. Are there only two mics here?
Well, I gave the speaking privileges to two folks, but yeah, so if you have any questions, this is the time to ask them, and then I'll go on to Doctore, I think. That's the name, D-R-E. So ask any questions.
Just I hate to... One of your objections, I actually thought had a germ of truth to it, and it's one that you had a lot of vitriol against, so I hesitate to bring it up.
No, no, please do. It's a safe space.
So I want to do everything I can to encourage you to keep doing these, by the way. I really think they're awesome. And I'm doing some philosophy lectures, and some of it's on philosophy of science. And objection number five that you brought up.
The unfalsifiable just-so storytelling?
Yeah.
Okay.
You put it in really, really negative terminology. So I'm going to just preface and throw clear this with, obviously, I understand that evolution is a science. I understand there are really rigorous methods. I'm not coming at it from a, you know, you guys are just making up just so stories kind of perspective. But I have one quick question, which is this.
Please.
Is there, so let's just talk evolution in general first before we go to behavior of people.
Sure.
Is there a hypothetical species that could exist that you couldn't come up with an evolutionary Darwinian explanation for its features?
Not that I'm aware of, no. Because that species did not materialize out of some magical process that is outside the purview. You know what I mean? So do you have something in mind?
Well, I guess, all right, look, I know how unfair this is going to sound, but if there were flying elephants, wouldn't you be able to come up with the explanation for why it was evolutionarily advantageous for them to develop the features that got them into flying?
Well, you're exactly aping that number five, right? So
that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying my best to take the one you hated.
So no, listen. I like it. Challenge me. Challenge away. So as I explained, and you know when I was talking about the nomological networks of cumulative evidence. Before I'm able to definitively state that something is an adaptation, I actually set the evidentiary threshold so high that it completely dwarfs any other science in terms of the scrupulosity that I approach the problem with, right? So in other words, if you have a problem with the level of epistemological proof that an evolutionist uses, then you should have a much bigger problem with any other scientist. Do you follow what I mean? So,
yes.
So, and let me. By the way, not only are evolutionists, you know, keen on building these nomological networks of cumulative evidence that I mentioned, but there's even a whole tradition within evolutionary biology and evolutionary psychology to try to offer a framework to know when something is an adaptation or an exaptation, for example. And I mentioned this briefly in my last lecture, the one that I held 4 weeks ago, but maybe some of the folks here may not have been there, so let me mention it again. An adaptation is a trait that has evolved either through natural selection or sexual selection because it confers either a survival advantage or a mating advantage, right? An exaptation is a trait that exists, to your point about possibly the elephants flying, it's a trait that exists because it is a byproduct of evolution. Itself, it's not an adaptation. So for example, the color of your skeletal system is that color, not because it is adaptive for it to have that color, but it's because it's a path-dependent engineering constraint. You follow what I mean? Because of this trajectory of evolution, the piggyback outcome is that our skeletal system is that color. So it's not as though all evolutionary psychologists and evolutionary biologists since Darwin are just these babbling buffoons who have no idea about epistemology and are sitting, as I said, you know, sipping cognac and smoking a cigar and pontificating. On the contrary, because we realize the onus that is placed on us in having the audacity to argue, yes, this is definitive, it is an adaptation, we're that much more judicious in our collection of data. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. From our philosophy of science perspective, we do actually have problems with astrophysics and those things that you're saying. So that's the conversation that we'd be having there. But I understand what you're saying, and I think it's correct in that context.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate you saying that. If you want, let me get through all the folks who are, you know, who requested to speak. I'll go to DRE next, and I think we've got another person. Hold on. We've got Money Penny. I'm going to give her also speaking privilege. So DRE, or is it Dre? Do you want to take it away?
It's Dre.
Take it away.
No, it's a study question. Like, I just discovered you, and I just discovered this branch. I've been meditating for like 25 years. My experience is basically, I met a lot of, spiritual gurus from the East, okay. But I never found, I just found you, and therefore I just discovered this Westerner framework for something that I was dwelling in by myself, so I want to know how to study more, how to improve it, if you have a suggestion or some resources that I can study more to actually, you know.
Oh, well, first of all, welcome. I am always so excited when a new person discovers, you know, the evolutionary lens. I always tell my students the first day they walk into class, I say, I guarantee you, and I say this without being presumptuous, I tell them, I'm going to blow your minds. Because until you are exposed to the evolutionary lens, there are so many phenomena that would have heretofore been invisible to you. And so the evolutionary lens, as I think I might have mentioned last class, last time we had this X Spaces session a couple of weeks ago, it's kind of like if you wanted to study something at the nano level, you couldn't until the methodology allowed you to have electronic microscopes to see things that otherwise you wouldn't have been able to see. Or similarly, if you want to study something at the cosmological level, you weren't able to study it because you didn't have the powerful telescopes that would allow you to study those particular distant galaxies. And so in those cases, you had to have advances in methodologies in order to crack certain phenomena that would have otherwise been literally invisible to you. Well, evolutionary theory does exactly that to you. It allows you to open up a range of phenomena. And suddenly now, oh, you understand why when you were 12 and your sibling were 15, they were your biggest enemy. You understand why you're fighting for the ridiculous, honor of having the corner office with the biggest windows. You understand why when you are ovulating, you're more likely to wear high heels. And so it becomes something that the cat is out of the bag and you can't unsee it. You start able to see things in a completely novel way. So welcome to the evolution. Go ahead.
You open a wide open door for me. Like I am already there since a lot of years. I just didn't have neither the framework nor the language to put it, because it was in all my personal meetings so far, and I had a very rich life. I'm not bragging; it's the first time that I actually meet a teacher that put my experiences into a perspective that only me saw, and never had a confrontation with. You know, so I understand what you're saying. Like everything that I just listened to like 10 minutes, the last 10 minutes, and you actually solved a frustration that I carry for 35 years.
Oh, that's amazing to hear. Thank you. That's so exciting. Thank you.
No, thank you. I mean, it was, I solved it by myself, like I accepted it. I never found the framework, you know, and somebody that said, you know, I never found the framework. Yeah. And
right.
So I would just want to get more tools to work.
So let me, you asked, I think you asked me what are some references you can read. Did you ask that?
Yes.
So let me.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's. So we can either go the book route or actual academic papers. What do you prefer?
Academic.
Academic papers. So here's what I suggest. So I have posted previously in the subscriber space several classic academic papers, but so you can go, I don't know if you can go back far enough in the subscriber only thread to see it, but I could tell you this, there is, just enter David Buss on Google Scholar, B-U-S-S. He is one of the pioneers, I mean, because I don't want to just cite my own papers and so on, right? I mean, so just do David Buss. You can go to around 1995, 19, and because really evolutionary psychology as a new distinct meta framework came into being in, around the late 80s. So around 1995 is when you had many of the pioneers of evolutionary psychology. So Lita Cosmides, John Tooby, David Buss. So their papers, or so for example, you could get a book called The Adapted Mind, which has a whole bunch of amazing academic papers from 1992. I think that would start you off on the right track. And then next time we have an X Spaces, you can ask me for some more references. How does that sound?
Absolutely. You made me so happy. You don't believe.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Let me go to Money Penny. Take it away. Oh my God! Stop giving me so many compliments. My ego's already pretty big. It's not gonna fit in this house anymore.
I love the enthusiasm of the Americans.
Well, all right, take it away. Give me your best question.
Okay. Best question. I want to talk to you about implicate order, sacred geometry, non-human intellectual, biological and physiological evolution compared to evolution in behaviors. But I most importantly want to know, in the word evolution, you have evolutionary behavioral science. Evolution suggests momentum and suggests a change of direction or an increase in direction. Necessarily positive normally, with the word evolution suggests a positive thing. So has the behavior of the human, who I think is specifically the creature with which you are studying, has it evolved in a positive way because evolution suggests it is doing so? And if it is evolutionary, and if it is down to behavior, how do you rationalize the change in the ability of the brain, the size of the brain, the degenerative size and mass of the brain to keep a constant with behavioral science?
Oh boy, that's a mouthful you got right there. Okay, let me just focus maybe on one part of it, because any part we can go off for the next 40 minutes. So evolution in the way you used it is not the way it's typically used. So it's not that evolution goes on a trajectory that leads to some final goal that is positive, right? Because as I mentioned in the general X Spaces, evolution also explains why we covet. Evolution also explains why we rape. Evolution also explains why we commit child abuse while we cheat on our spouses. So there isn't a moral positive quality to the term evolution. All that we mean by evolution is that there are selection pressures that cause some behavior to become part of the genotype of the repertoire of the human condition. Do you follow what I mean? So that could be negative, it could be positive. There is no sort of moral quality to it. Exactly. Okay, so we're in agreement there. So let me maybe put it in a very concrete way, because sometimes by just giving an actual example, it kind of solves the philosophizing. So take, for example, the fact that while both men and women are sexually territorial, meaning that we don't like the idea of sharing our, partners with someone else, there is a much more, certainly violent reaction when a woman either cheats on a man or is suspected of cheating on a man. So to go back to a comment that I made in the general session prior to our subscriber-only session, where I was talking about the book Homicide that looked at patterns of criminality from an evolutionary perspective, it turns out that the most dangerous person in a woman's life throughout all of recorded history across every known culture that's ever been studied is not the serial killer that lies in wait in the bushes. It's her long-term partner, right? It's her husband. By far, that is the most dangerous person in a woman's life. And it doesn't matter whether it's 8,000 years ago or 8,000 years from now, or it's the Yanomamo tribe in the Amazon, or it's somewhere in Britain or somewhere in Canada. It's always the case that usually it's her long-term partner. And the reason why he becomes so violent is usually because of either suspected or realized infidelity. So then an evolutionist would come along and say, okay, so what would be the evolutionary reason for men to have evolved the emotional, cognitive, and behavioral systems to be so unforgiving of, adultery? Do you know the answer to that, Money Penny, or anybody else?
And that male wants to covet and keep that reproductive person who has committed to them as theirs, as a property.
But why? Why is it so important that I view my long-term partner as my sexual territory? Why though? What's the...
Because it's the legacy. Like it's a heritage that you carry within your blood that needs to pass through the other to the female partner, and therefore you lose your biological traces to the world. Like you don't participate in evolution.
Okay, so let me summarize what you guys have said, and I'll just put specific words because neither of you specifically said them. There is no such thing as maternity uncertainty, but boy, there is such a thing as paternity uncertainty. Now, paternity uncertainty doesn't matter if the species is not biparental. But human beings are actually classified as a biparental species, meaning that human males are actually super dads when it comes to other mammalian species. We do much more than simply provide, a spermatozoa, right? It's not just the act of copulation that we provide. We actually invest heavily in our children. Maybe not as much as mothers, but we're very heavily vested. So it wouldn't make sense that your ancestors and mine, at least the male ancestors, would have been completely okay with their women philandering left, right, and center, because then I'm going to be spending the next 18 years of my life investing very heavily in children that look like the sexy gardener who comes to do our bushes. Either literally or metaphorically, right? And therefore, I've evolved the very unforgiving attitude of being very sexually territorial. So this, by the way, is an example of how the fact that I explain why men are sexually territorial doesn't mean that I'm condoning, domestic violence. But to the extent that we know, for example, that if a woman cheats on a man, it's about a 90% chance that this will end the marriage. In other words, it is an absolute near fatal death to the relationship. You can't come back from that. On the other hand, when a man cheats on a woman, it's only about 30% likely that the death, you know, of the relationship. So when I ask, let's say, my students, well, why, what, before they know anything about evolutionary theory, well, why would this be the case? Why is there this sex difference? So usually they'll give all sorts of proximate answers like, well, it's because women are more forgiving. Oh, well, it's because men have a more fragile ego. Well, these things might be true, but they're only true at the proximate level. The ultimate level is that men face paternity uncertainty and women don't. Therefore, I expect men to be very unforgiving of that behavior. So just understanding that, my God, it opens up all sorts of explanations for all of these sex differences that we see between men and women. And by the way, that's another reason why social constructivists hate evolutionary theory. Social constructivists are social scientists who think that everything is due to a social construction, which is pure bullshit, right? I mean, of course, socialization matters, but socialization takes place in its form because of biology, not in lieu of biology. So there you have it. Did you have anything else you want me to answer, Moneypenny?
Gender dysphoria, then, how does it fit in with that?
Say again?
Gender dysphoria.
Oh, yes.
How does that fit in with what we've just discussed?
So gender dysphoria, the way that I would explain it is that during the... So there is no... Actually, to Zara's point, remember when he said, well, is there any species that can, you know, exist that is not due to evolution? Well, so there isn't a species that is outside the purview of evolution, but there are phenomena within a species that are outside the purview of an adaptive argument. So what do I mean by that? That's a mouthful, so let me explain. When the human brain is being sex type, okay, ontogenetically, developmentally, there is a whole cascade of programs that are being run for that sex typing to work. That sex typing can go awry. Now, people don't like to hear that because now in today's political correct world, are you saying you disgusting transphobe that it is abnormal to, you know, be gender dysphoric? Well, from a Darwinian sexual reproduction perspective, yes, it is abnormal. That's why until 14 seconds ago, it was classified as a psychiatric disorder, right? Now we have to all celebrate it and orgiastically self-flagellate whenever someone says, I have a nine inch penis, but I'm a woman. And we have to say, well, of course you could enter with my 8-year-old daughter and take showers with her because you're both just little girls. One of you happens to be a 6'2", 280-pound biological male with a 9-inch penis, but you say you're a woman, therefore that's it. You're a woman, right? But of course, that's pure. And by the way, I'm not denigrating the fact that gender dysphoria truly does exist. But it is a problem of sex typing. So there is no evolutionary argument for why gender dysphoria exists. It's just shit happens, right? And so, of course, transgender people should be treated with full dignity. Of course, they should be free of, institutionalized bigotry. But to argue that it is just a natural part of the full richness of spectrum of the default value of humanity, bullshit, right? Sexually reproducing species come in two phenotypes. They're called male and female. And stating that, exactly to the point that I made in the X spaces, stating that doesn't mean that transgender people don't exist, but it certainly doesn't mean that sex and gender comes on a spectrum. There you have it. Anybody else have any questions or comments for me?
I need to ask a quick question, please. An Alan Bloom type question from you here. Number 9 seems like the stupidest objection to me. Generalization is a kind of thinking. I totally understand what you mean about people raise their hand with one counterexample.
Yes.
My question to you is this. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, the likelihood of a student making that stupid objection, was it as high as it is today, or am I detecting something like we're all losing our goddamn
I would love to be able to tell you that the rate of succumbing to that fallacy has decreased, but the capacity for human stupidity is endless and limitless, as our good friend Albert Einstein said. I don't know if it's an actual quote, but you remember the quote of, what is it? There are two things that are infinite. What is it? The cosmos and human stupidity, or something like that? Am I getting the quote right?
I don't know. I think so. I generally, it sounds like my suspicion was that it had gone up, actually.
Okay.
It wasn't a phenomenon 25 years ago that people didn't understand what generalization was.
Why would you think it would go up? What's the mechanism that...
No, it's just based on observation. I just think that, you know, our culture is losing its ability to reason. Our reasoning capacity is going in the wrong direction. But I wanted to know, is that your experience with that one question, or is it basically just as steady as...
No, it's a steady. You know why? Because I think the human mind, it's that obstacle, and it's like, I understand when you said that's the stupidest one to, you know, that to levy, the number 9. But in reality, it's one that's very difficult. I mean, you can overcome it and that you explain it, but it's one that's so easy to succumb to, because it is an inherent feature of the architecture of the human mind, right? The human mind sees singular exemplars informing its reality. Do you understand what I'm saying? So we're not intuitive statisticians. We're not intuitive, you know, normal distribution curve people, right? You have to study that to understand that reality. So for most of us, you know, I see an exemplar, and that becomes the way by which I view. And so this may not be exactly related, but I think you'll appreciate what I'm trying to analogize here. This is actually an example that I used against my good friend Jordan Peterson when he was arguing for Jungian synchronicity, and I was telling him politely that it's a bunch of shite. And so I gave him this explanation for that. So let me try to break it down for you. So there's something in psychology of decision making called the cell A bias. And let me explain what that means. It's actually incredibly profound, because it really speaks to why it is that human minds can so predictably succumb to all of these cognitive errors. Okay. If I say to you, you know, it's unbelievable, Zara, every time I'm in the shower, the phone rings, right? Now, and my brain has actually calculated that, yes, that really seems to be the case, that there is some kind of statistical perversion in the universe whereby somehow every time I enter the shower, the phone rings. Now, here is why this is completely false, but why it's so easy for us to make that mistake. Actually, the space of possible events, it's a 2x2 matrix. The phone can ring or not, and I could be taking a shower or not. You follow? Are you with me so far, Zara?
Yeah, no, I totally understand.
Right?
Yep.
So now what happens to my brain? The reason why it's called cell A bias, because my brain only codes the occurrences where the phone rings and I'm in the shower. The three other cells don't get coded because they're non-events in terms of alerting my brain. And therefore, I overestimate the probability that every time I goddamn get into the shower, the phone rings. And so this is a long roundabout way of answering your earlier question, which is, it's an endemic flaw of the architecture of the human mind to succumb to number 9. It just always happens, every class.
Yeah. Okay, but you're telling me it happens every class now, and that isn't worse than it used to be a decade or two ago?
Yes, sir.
Okay, fine. I mean, look, generalization is almost a different process than that confirmation bias, right? I mean, it's like you're seeing... Okay, never mind. I'm glad. I'm optimistic to hear that.
Although, I mean, to your point, I did write The Parasitic Mind, which speaks to your more general point, which is we are facing a unique epidemic of parasitized minds. It may not be of the variety of point number nine that I mentioned, but there is a whole slew of other parasitic ideas that people are succumbing to at an increasing rate. So your point does apply longitudinally to other parasitic obstacles, just not that particular one.
I just didn't remember people, I mean, not understanding what generalization is and thinking it's a fallacy when it's actually a thinking process.
Right.
But apparently... All right, cool.
Thank you so much. Money Penny, did you have your hand up or you just didn't bring it down from last time?
No, I have two questions and I will stand in line for other people, but as nobody else had their hands up. First of all, I really feel empathy for you, that you constantly have to give us a disclaimer of not wanting to offend people. Everybody in this space who knows you well enough and understands the subject, the topic matter well enough, realizes that you're not trying to cause any offense by saying something that might in, you know, normal life outside of this scientific community be perceived as being, you know, anti-sexual or anti-gender or anti-whatever the weird thing is that, you know, the world is coming up with at the moment. I really feel for you and having to constantly give that disclaimer.
Thank you.
Sure, hopefully your subscribers will be understanding enough that you wouldn't have to do that all the time, but it must be hard for you, especially because there's stupidity going on in the world. Evolutionary stupidity, I think, and we are all growing adept at being able to hang on to a virtual world of Instagrammers and celebrities that do nothing other than get, you know, loads of impediments because they are, you know, whatever they are. Right, I'll stop rambling.
Go ahead. Can you speak a bit closer to the thing? I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Let me adjust this.
Oh, that's much better, yes.
Oh, good, good. I've got a new iPhone. I've never used iPhone. I've been on Android for 20 years, and I don't even know how to work this bloody thing. I'm more of a biologist in terms of scientific awareness, although I do follow all the sciences. What I'm fascinated in terms of evolutionary psychology, is how we can match that alongside an evolutionary physiological change, particularly in the human brain, and that's not the only organ, because there are other organs that dictate gender dysphoria. The vomeronasal organ, which is an organ some people have never heard of, that humans have in the upper part of their palate, that dictates pheromones and dictates the human desire to reproduce and the human desire to want to be a certain gender before we've even got into sexuality. That is evolving. The human body is evolving in terms of the cellular makeup, the physiological makeup of the brain, the cellular parts of the brain, and even the parts of the cells themselves. So how do we put that alongside evolutionary psychology, because neither is a constant to judge one against the other?
So I'm not exactly sure how to answer that, because I can't exactly pinpoint your question. So if you mean, are you saying, when you're saying...
Our brain power is changing, and our emotional stability and volatility is changing.
Do you mean within the lifespan of a single individual, or do you mean across the species?
Humanity as a whole.
Well, okay, so I don't know if what I'm going to answer is going to satisfy your question, but let me maybe address it in this. It may be oblique or it may be not. So what I'm hearing in your question is, in a sense, it's about the rate of evolutionary change, okay? So in other words, the fact that we have 10 fingers now has become what's called a fixed trait. In other words, not that theoretically speaking, we can't have some future where it would be adaptive for us to have 11 traits, but it is now a fixed trait that if you're born with anything other than 10 fingers, that would be a developmental anomaly. That's why when a child is born, usually the nurse, the first thing that he or she does is they count the number of toes and fingers, because it is understood that that's a fixed trait, okay? So many traits that typically evolutionists talk about are fixed in that way, albeit some are more prone to evolutionary change than others. So for example, my proclivity to synthesize lactose could actually be selected out or selected for within just a few generations. But on the other hand, whether I evolve a third eye or an 11th finger, it's going to take a hell of a lot longer for that prospective change to take place. You understand what I'm saying? So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but you'd have to tell me exactly which specific trait you're talking about, and then I'd be able to maybe surmise whether that particular trait is open for rapid evolutionary change or not. Does that make sense?
It does, and I apologize, I have not been more specific. So let me be specific.
Sure.
Men are now being born and are more likely to have less reproductive ability, lower sperm count,
yes,
lower testosterone, lower what we would require in a reproductive sense to make them male, less male,
yes,
in a generic sense, at a big generic macro sense. Women, equally, are more predisposed now to take on what we have regarded in society as a male characteristic, the survival of the species, the woman living alone, the single parent. But a lot of that is because there has been a change in the hormonal and the reproductive physiological,
yes,
parts of a man and a woman. We are seeing animals being born without a Y chromosome. It's not that far away from a man, a human being born without a Y chromosome. So that physiological change is surely going to have an impact, or already is, on evolutionary psychology.
Yes. Okay, so now I understand a bit better your question. Although it will take a lot more of the current environment for that to manifest itself in fixed trait changes in male and female psychology. Do you follow what I'm saying? So, example, let me give you a great example that links back to our earlier question about paternity uncertainty, right? So today we have DNA paternity testing, correct? So theoretically, the threat of paternity uncertainty has been environmentally solved. Like, in other words, I don't need to be concerned about whether the child is mine or not, because I just have to take a follicle of their hair and put a DNA paternity test, and I could know if my daughter is really my daughter. Notwithstanding that environmental change, men have not selected out all of the behavioral, cognitive, and emotional systems that were meant to solve the problem of paternity uncertainty. You follow what I mean? Because my sexual jealousy is an adaptive solution to an evolutionary problem that was recurring in my evolutionary past. It's going to take a lot longer for me to select that out. So let me give you another example with a physical trait. Mole rats who live underground have now had their eyesight selected out. They no longer have eyes. They don't need eyes. But it took a very long evolutionary process for them to lose those. So what you're suggesting about there are now environmental factors that are making males less male and females less female, that might be true. But for it to have long-term downstream consequences, that recurring reality would have to hold on for a lot longer for that to happen. Does that make sense?
It does. Indeed, it does, yes. But if we go back to vestigial organs,
yes,
organs that we no longer use.
Appendix.
Like the appendix, yes. But also like the vomeronasal organ that I mentioned.
Yes.
The appendix has been vestigial for a long, long time. How has that affected the evolutionary psychology of somebody who is no longer using an organ that was originally had a purpose in their body?
So I don't know about that specific organ and how that might, affect our sex-specific evolutionary psychology. One of the things that you'll find in knowing about my work, I'm well calibrated in terms of my epistemic humility. When I know something, I speak with all the authority of someone who knows it. When I don't know something, I'll be the first to say, You know what? You got me on this one. I don't think I can answer. So I can't specifically comment about that particular organ and how that might have downstream consequences on male and female psychology. I simply don't know enough about that organ to offer.
Very fair. Very fair.
Yeah.
So at a macro generic level, as changes within the human body become significant to that person's emotions, social skills, intellect, social ability with others, does evolutionary psychology evolve with it?
It does, but again, it depends on which trait it is, right? So as I said before, both the gene for synthesizing lactose and the genes that establish that we have 10 fingers are part of our human genome, but the former can be selected out or selected for much, much more quickly than the latter, right? Because the latter is a fixed trait, the former is not, right? So for example, take another example. Our personalities are not fixed traits. You follow what I'm saying? So in other words, there isn't a singular optimal personality profile. Some of us, so if you look at say personality psychology, there are well over 10,000 personality traits, which of course could be distilled down. So for example, some people talk about the big five, right? There are five key personality traits on which most of us vary, right? And that can capture much of our heterogeneity. But the reality is, one could ask, why is it that evolution has not come up with a singular personality profile that is optimal? And actually, the answer is a beautiful, elegant one. And that's because there isn't a singular personality profile that is optimal across all social ecosystems. That's why evolution has not come up with a single personality profile, right? So think of it from, say, a personnel psychology. When you go to a job interview and the company administers a personality test to you, it's not because they want to see what your personality scores are. It's because they want to see whether your personality matches with the organizational culture of that organization, right? So my personality might match really well with Google, but not match well with JP Morgan, right? My personality didn't change, but it is optimal in ecosystem A, but suboptimal in ecosystem B. And so the argument is that the reason why we don't have fixed personality traits in the same way that we have, say, fixed toes and fixed fingers is because there isn't a singular optimal solution that evolution can, you know, tend its weaponry on. It depends on the ecosystem. So all this long-winded thing to answer your question, which is, it really depends. Depending on which trait you're talking about, it could take 500 years for the evolutionary psychology repercussions to change, or it could take 5 million years. I can't say. It depends on the trait. Let me see if there's anybody else here. Oh, we've got Professor Brian Keating is here. Does he want... Hold on a second. And he's got... Wait a second. We got Dr. Keating. All right. How are you doing, sir? Why aren't you speaking?
Hello.
How are you, Brian?
I'm great. How are you, my godfather?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's so nice for you to drop in. Folks, this is Professor Brian Keating, big, big, big astrophysicist from University of California, San Diego. I've been on his show. He's been on mine. Just a great guy. Jewish guy. Does that matter? It doesn't matter. But he's also Jewish. We both... What's that? Don't give your secret away. We're both... Are you also a Mossad agent? Because a couple of weeks ago it came out that I was a certified Mossad agent. Are you willing to come clean here and admit that you are a Mossad agent?
Not only that, my godfather, but did you know my middle name is Gregory, so my initials are BGK, which if you read the Hebraic, Judaic way backwards, right to left becomes KGB, and furthermore... Did you know the two letters that end the word Shabak? So BK, is in there somewhere.
Holy, you've got way too much time on your hands to play with all those acronyms, Professor.
Oh, my godfather, I only have a minute. I'm sorry. I'm hosting a friend from this very frigid place called Montreal. I don't know. Have you ever been there? He's from McGill. He's from McGill University. He's a legitimate theoretical cosmologist, a mentor, and a beloved friend. I'm hosting for dinner where I've invited you about six times. And one of these days when you're not on a book tour scratching elbows with those millionaire trillionaires, I will host you here and you will sup and I will convert you.
I look forward to it, sir. I look forward to it.
So I have 1 minute. I need this answer. So
please.
I'm hosting the Malibu Meditator tomorrow. My friend and yours, Sam Harris. So I run the Into the Impossible podcast. I'm hosting Sam. He's graciously agreed to come on the podcast. He said, any podcast that's hosted Gadsad has got to be good enough to host it. What one, Chris, not offensive, people are saying, you know, I put out a request on
yes.
Twitter, X, formerly X, now Twitter, I don't know. And I said, what question would you, and like 90% of them, like, do you feel like you're a stooge because you had all these COVID? I actually think that there are some reasons, maybe evolution, maybe not. That he might have had his opinions. I don't agree with everything he says, but I don't agree with everything I say half the time. Only you, my friend. So, one question, something that's thoughtful. I'm going to talk primarily scientific, even the cosmological, even alien life, things regarding AI, artificial intelligence. But is there any one crisp question
yes.
that you didn't get to talk to him about when on your many appearances with him, but maybe I could ask him, and it would be respectful, because
I got you.
You are, I always like to be respectful.
I got you. So this is a fantastic question, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to answer it. So I mentioned earlier in the general X Spaces, which you may have not been at, where I was talking about a show that I recently appeared on, hosted by a British psychiatrist, where at the end of the show, he asked me a question which surprisingly no one had previously asked me. And so that's going to be the question that I'm going to ask you to ask Sam. So he had asked me, the British psychiatrist, of all your 30 years of being a professor and a behavioral scientist, what's the singular finding that has most surprised you about the human condition? Which is, of course, a huge question. So I thought for a minute and then I said, you know what? I think the inability of people to be willing to change their positions on something once they are fully anchored on that position is probably the thing that has surprised me the most, because I've come with perhaps a naive, pure view of humans that they are intellectually honest and they are purveyors of truth. And if only they give you a chance to lay out your arguments, if they're honest enough, they will change their opinions. And so having said that, Brian, my question I would ask you to ask Sam is there any information that he could ever receive that would cause him to, for example, alter his position on Donald Trump being the existential threat of humanity?
Really? But the answer, you know, Gad, and you know so much better than I, the human condition, psychological condition, but I don't expect that answer would provide what, you know, statisticians call surprise or entropy or information, because I can almost anticipate what he'd say based on other things he'd say. And for me, I want to ask him things that he hasn't really been asked, as I always like to tailor to my guests, like I do with you. And
sure.
Now. And so I guess for me, I see it as, I'm trying to see it from his perspective. I'm trying to steel man the Sam. And from that perspective, I can only come up, and I've talked to people that are much worse PDS than he is. Lawrence Tribe, I talked to him.
Yes.
Even when I said to Lawrence, this second impeachment that you're trying to foist upon him, isn't that actually counter to the Democratic goals? Because if you succeed in your wildest dreams and you orgiastically celebrate the impeachment and orange jumpsuit of the Donald, right? That happens. Then you get someone who's 80 times more likely to beat Joe Biden in the next election, as everybody agrees, even you know,
right.
People that despise. So, in other words, I know what he's going to say, but Lawrence Tribe, to his credit or shame, said, no, this is a matter of principle. We can't monkey with democracy. Democracy's on the line. And I've heard Sam say this many times, and it's sort of a cost fallacy at this point. He's just going to You know, so what I would say to him is, I might phrase it differently, or maybe it's the same. I don't think I'll mention that exact question. But to me, the existence of a first term gives us Bayesian priors on what will happen in the second term.
Right.
And I was thinking of leading up to it like this. Maybe I'm a sneaky, you know what? But I was thinking of this, Gad, and I want your opinion. I don't have that much time. I'm so sorry. But I maybe I'll listen off the air, as they used to say. But I would say this. If you found a planet in the habitable zone of a distant yellow star 50 light years away, and there was a dual planet right nearby, and you saw that planet had on it life forms, technology, it had on, you know, Instagram and TikTok and Twitter spaces, and subscriptions to Gad's app. Like that, what would you estimate, just purely as a Bayesian, what would you estimate the probability of there being life, just life, on the other planet right next door? In other words, you apply Bayesian prior. And so then if he would say, well, I would think it would be very high. I'd say, well, we have that, you know, Earth and Mars, and we don't see any life on Mars. So could I infer that, like, the likelihood of doing damage in your second term must be at some Bayesian level of falsifiability predicated on the probability of him overturning democracy in his first term, which did not occur, to my knowledge. So maybe that's the way I'd phrase it, but... But and I agree, I'm sort of interested in it, but I was hoping more for something unique.
So here's one I could... Do you have another minute? I know you have to go.
Yeah, sure. For you, yes.
So thank you. So this is more of a personal question. One of the things I like to do often with guests is, of course, you ask them all sorts of questions about their, you know, their expertise. Hold on. What's going on?
I'm talking to my kid.
Oh, okay. Okay, so one of the things I like to do is oftentimes get more intimate with the guests. So because in my last book, The Happiness Book, I have a chapter on regret. So one of the things that I've taken to doing with many of my guests is towards the end of my chat, I begin by explaining the psychology of regret, regret due to action versus regret due to inaction. And it turns out, Brian, as I think you probably remember, I think we probably discussed it when I came on your show, that most people, their biggest looming regret is one due to inaction, right? I wish I had become an artist rather than become an astrophysicist like my father was, right? And so one thing that might be fun, which might kind of humanize Sam, which might, you know, be interesting in terms of asking him to answer a personal question, is to set up the regret question and say, so are you willing to share with us what might be your one or two top regrets so far in your life? That might be a cool one.
Yeah, I like that because he has said, he has talked a lot about happiness, and he actually said something that was quite, you know, illuminating for me at one point. He said, you can't be happy. You can only become happy. And I don't know if you agree with that or not. Basically saying, like, happiness is an unstable equilibrium point. Once you get there, it's balancing the pencil. At this point, it's going to tip in one way or another. It's hard to imagine your life right now. And I wish I had the chance to talk to you about this when you were on my podcast. But please God, or, you know, Yahweh, or whatever you want to say, that you'll be back many times.
Of course.
But I wanted to ask you, you know, how can I legitimately, meaningfully double your happiness? It could happen, right? You could be like you and Messi could go out, you know, go have these on a mega yacht, and he could invite you to the bar. You'd be twice as happy, right? But it's hard to imagine you being 10 times. I mean, you're already one of the happiest people I know, despite living.
You know, I'm so happy because I get guys like you guys coming in at 8:30 having these incredible chats with me. I'm the richest guy in the world.
Yeah, exactly. But I have to say, to take the mood down, make it a little more somber, I can think of any parent can think of an infinite number of ways to make their life infinitely worse.
Yes.
And I wanted to ask him about that in the context of that's really a statement of the second law of thermodynamics. Once you achieve happiness, there's this terror that I have. I've got a wonderful life here. But I'm always terrified, Gad.
Yes.
Awful happens. And anyone who's a parent knows this, and that's why I encourage so many people to be parents. And in fact, my motto is do the things that, if taken away from you, would devastate you. And if you do those things, you'll have a very rich life. But maybe I should sign off now.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much, Brian, for coming. We'll talk again. Money Penny, I would love to take another one from you, but I'm way over the time limit. I'd like to still stay married to my wife and so that she doesn't divorce me. So if you don't mind, we'll hopefully continue it in the next X Spaces. Guys, thank you so much for coming. I wish more of you showed up, but it's quality over quantity.
Thank you so much. We all want to thank you so much for doing these
things. Thank you, guys. Awesome. Can I ask you guys for a favor? Could you please, please tell your friends about it? I want to build a huge community. It's not about the money. It's imagine how much more exciting it is if I could turn this on and there are 10,000 people listening. 50,000. I want more British people. I love the accent. It turns me on. So please bring more British people, as long as they are not Liverpool supporters.
I love it.
No, I'm just kidding. Thanks so much, guys, and I'll talk to you soon. I'm heading off to Arizona State University to talk about woke universities. Let's hope they don't shut me down. Wish me luck, and I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much, guys. Cheers.
God bless.
God bless. Ciao.